preferred books to society. He felt inhibited among people, and was often tormented by doubts and self-criticism. He was well-read for his age, and had a leaning toward aesthetic intellectualism. After an earlier atheistic stage, he became rigorously Protestant, but finally his religious attitude became completely neutral. He had chosen a technical education because he felt his talents lay in mathematics and geometry. He possessed a logical mind, trained in the natural sciences, but he also had a propensity toward the irrational and mystical that he did not want to admit even to himself. About 2 years before his analysis began, Henry had become engaged to a Catholic girl from the French part of Switzerland. He described her as charming, efficient, and full of initiative. Nevertheless, he was uncertain whether he should undertake the responsibility of marriage. Since he had so little acquaintance with girls, he thought it might be better to wait, or even to remain a bachelor dedicated to a scholarly life. His doubts were strong enough to prevent his reaching a decision. He needed a further step toward maturity before he could feel sure of himself. Although qualities of both his parents were combined in Henry, he was markedly mother-bound. In his consciousness, he was identified with his real or light mother, who represented high ideals and intellectual ambitions. But in his unconscious, he was deeply in the power of the dark aspects of his mother-bound condition. His unconscious still held his ego in a stranglehold. All his clear-cut thinking and his efforts to find a firm standpoint in the purely rational remained nothing more than an intellectual exercise. The need to escape from this mother prison was expressed in hostile reactions to his real mother and a rejection of the inner mother as a symbol of the feminine side of the unconscious. But an inner power sought to hold him back in the condition of childhood, resisting everything that attracted him to the outside world. Even the attractions of his fiancée were not enough to free him from his mother ties and thus help him find himself. He was not aware that his inner urge for growth, which he felt strongly, included the need to detach himself from his mother. My analytical work with Henry lasted 9 months. Altogether, there were 35 sessions in which he presented 50 dreams. So short an analysis is rare. It is only possible when energy-laden dreams like Henry's speed up the process of development. Of course, from the Jungian point of view, there is no rule for the length of time required for a successful analysis. All depends on the individual's readiness to realize inner facts and on the material presented by his unconscious. Like most introverts, Henry led a rather monotonous outer life. During the day, he was completely involved in his job. In the evenings, he sometimes went out with his fiancée or with friends, with whom he liked to have literary discussions. Quite often, he sat in his lodgings, absorbed in a book or in his own thoughts. Though we regularly discussed the happenings of his daily life, and also his childhood and youth, we usually got fairly quickly to the investigation of his dreams and the problems his inner life presented to him. It was extraordinary to see how strongly his dreams emphasized his call to spiritual development. But I must make it clear that not everything described here was told to Henry. In analysis, one must always remain conscious of how explosive the dreamer's dream symbols may be for him. The analyst can hardly be too careful and reserved. If too bright a light is thrown on the dream language of symbols, the dreamer can be driven into anxiety and thus led into rationalization as a defense mechanism. Or he can no longer assimilate them and can fall into a severe psychic crisis. Also, the dreams reported and commented on here are by no means all the dreams that Henry had during his analysis. I can discuss only an important few that influenced his development. In the beginning of our work, childhood memories with important symbolic meanings came up. The oldest dated back to Henry's 4th year. He said, "One morning I was allowed to go with my mother to the baker's shop, and there I received a crescent roll from the baker's wife. I did not eat the roll, but carried it proudly in my hand. Only my mother and the baker's wife were present, so I was the only man." Such crescents are popularly called moon teeth, and this symbolic allusion to the moon underlines the dominating power of the feminine, a power to which the little boy may have felt exposed, and which, as the only man, he was proud of being able to confront. Another childhood memory came from his 5th year. It concerned Henry's sister, who came home after her examinations at school, and found him constructing a toy barn. The barn was made with blocks of wood, arranged in the form of a square, and surrounded with a kind of hedge that looked like the battlements of a castle. Henry was pleased with his achievement, and said teasingly to his sister, "You have started school, but you're already on holiday." Her reply, that he was on holiday all year, upset him terribly. He felt deeply hurt that his achievement was not taken seriously. Even years later, Henry had not forgotten the bitter hurt and injustice that he had felt when his construction was rejected. His later problems concerning the assertion of his masculinity and the conflict between rational and fantasy values are already visible in this early experience, and these problems are also to be seen in the images of his first dream. The initial dream. The day after Henry's first visit to me, he had the following dream. I was on an excursion with a group of people I did not know. We were going to the Zinalrothorn. We had started from Zamodin. We only walked about an hour because we were to camp and have some theatricals. I was not given an active part. I especially remember one performer, a young woman in a pathetic role wearing a long flowing robe. It was midday, and I wanted to go on to the pass. As all the others preferred to remain, I went up alone, leaving my equipment behind. However, I found myself right back in the valley and completely lost my orientation. I wanted to return to my party, but did not know which mountainside I should climb. I was hesitant about asking. Finally, an old woman showed me the way I must go. Then I ascended from a different starting point than our group had used in the morning. It was a matter of making a turn at the right altitude, and then following the mountain slope to return to the party. I climbed along a cogwheel mountain railway on the right side. On my left, little cars constantly passed me, each containing one hidden, bloated little man in a blue suit. It is said they are dead. I was afraid of other cars coming from behind and kept turning around to look so as not to be run over. My anxiety was needless. At the point where I had to turn off to the right, there were people awaiting me. They took me to an inn. A cloudburst came up. I regretted that my equipment, my rucksack, and my motorbike were not there, but I was told not to get them till next morning. I accepted the advice. Dr. Jung assigned great importance to the first dream in an analysis, for according to him, it often has anticipatory value. A decision to go into analysis is usually accompanied by an emotional upheaval that disturbs the deep psychic levels from which archetypal symbols arise. The first dreams, therefore, often present collective images that provide a perspective for the analysis as a whole and can give the therapist insight into the dreamer's psychic conflicts. What does the above dream tell us of Henry's future development? We must first examine some of the associations that Henry himself supplied. The village of Zamodin had been the home of Jörg Jenatsch, a famous 17th-century Swiss freedom fighter. The theatricals called up the thought of Goethe's Wilhelm Meister's Lehrjahre, which Henry liked very much. In the woman, he saw a resemblance to the figure in a painting called The Island of the Dead by the 19th-century Swiss artist Arnold Berklin. The wise old woman, as he called her, seemed to be associated on the one hand to his analyst, on the other to the charwoman in J.B. Priestley's play They Came to a City. The cogwheel railway reminded him of the barn with battlements that he had built as a child. The dream describes an excursion, a sort of walking tour, which is a striking parallel to Henry's decision to undertake analysis. The individuation process is often symbolized by a voyage of discovery to unknown lands. Such a voyage takes place in John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress or in Dante's Divina Commedia. The traveler, in Dante's poem, searching for a way, comes to a mountain that he decides to climb. But because of three strange animals, a motif that will also appear in one of Henry's later dreams, he is forced to descend into the valley and even into hell. Later, he ascends again to purgatory and finally reaches paradise. From this parallel, one could deduce that there might be a similar period of disorientation and lonely seeking in store for Henry. The first part of this life journey, represented as climbing a mountain, offers ascent from the unconscious to an elevated point of view of the ego, that is, to an increased consciousness. Zamodin is named as the starting point of the excursion. This is where Jenatsch, whom we may take as embodying the freedom-seeking sense within Henry's unconscious, started his campaign for the liberation of the Veltlin region of Switzerland from the French. Jenatsch had other characteristics in common with Henry. He was a Protestant who fell in love with a Catholic girl, and, like Henry, whose analysis was to free him from his mother ties and from fear of life, Jenatsch also fought for liberation. One could interpret this as a favorable augury for the success of Henry's own fight for freedom. The goal of the excursion is at Zinalrothorn, a mountain in western Switzerland that he did not know. The word Rot, red, in Zinalrothorn, touches on Henry's emotional problem. Red is usually symbolic of feeling or passion. Here it points to the value of the feeling function, which was insufficiently developed in Henry. And the word horn reminds one of the crescent roll in the baker's shop of Henry's childhood. After a short walk, a halt is called, and Henry can return to a state of passivity. This also belongs to his nature. The point is underlined by the theatricals. Attending the theater, which is an imitation of real life, is a popular way of evading an active part in life's drama. The spectator can identify with the play, yet continue to pander to his fantasies. This kind of identification permitted the Greeks to experience catharsis, much as the psychodrama initiated by the American psychiatrist J. L. Marino is now used as a therapeutic aid. Some such process may have enabled Henry to undergo an inner development when his associations raised memories of Wilhelm Meister, Goethe's story of the maturing of a young man. That Henry should have been impressed by the romantic appearance of a woman is also not surprising. This figure resembles Henry's mother and is at the same time a personification of his own unconscious feminine side. The connection Henry makes between her and Berkelin's Island of the Dead points to his depressive mood, so well expressed by the painting, which shows a white-robed priest-like figure steering a boat bearing a coffin toward an island. We have here a significant double paradox. The keel of the boat seems to suggest a contrary course, away from the island, and the priest is a figure of uncertain sex. In Henry's associations, this figure is certainly hermaphroditic. The double paradox coincides with Henry's ambivalence. The opposites in his soul are still too undifferentiated to be clearly separated. After this interlude in the dream, Henry suddenly becomes aware that it is noon and he must go on. So he again starts for the pass. A mountain pass is a well-known symbol for a situation of transition that leads from an old attitude of mind to a new one. Henry must go alone. It is essential for his ego to surmount the test unaided. Thus he leaves his kit behind, an action that signifies that his mental equipment has become a burden, or that he must change his normal way of going about things. But he does not reach the pass. He loses his bearings and finds himself back in the valley. This failure shows that while Henry's ego decides on activity, his other psychic entities, represented by the other members of the party, remain in the old state of passivity and refuse to accompany the ego. When the dreamer himself appears in a dream, he usually represents only his conscious ego. The other figures stand for his more or less unknown unconscious qualities. Henry is in a situation where he is helpless, yet ashamed to admit it. At this moment, he meets an old woman who indicates the right way to him. He can do nothing but accept her advice. The helpful old woman is a well-known symbol in myths and fairy tales for the wisdom of the eternal female nature. The rationalist Henry hesitates to accept her help because such acceptance requires a sacrificium intellectus, a sacrifice or discarding of a rational way of thought. This demand will often be made of Henry in later dreams. Such a sacrifice is unavoidable. It applies to his relationship with the analysis as well as with everyday life. He associated the figure of the old woman to the charwoman in Priestley's play about a new dream city, perhaps an analogy to the New Jerusalem of the Apocalypse, into which the characters can enter only after a kind of initiation. This association seems to show that Henry had intuitively recognized this confrontation as something decisive for him. The charwoman in Priestley's play says that in the city they have promised me a room of my own. There she will be self-reliant and independent, as Henry seeks to be. If such a technically minded young man as Henry is consciously to choose the way of psychic development, he must be prepared for a reversal of his old attitudes. Therefore, on the advice of the woman, he must start his climb from a different spot. Only then will it be possible for him to judge at what level he must deviate to reach the group, the other qualities of his psyche, that he had left behind. He climbs a cogwheel railway track, a motif perhaps reflecting his technical education, and keeps to the right side of the track, which is the conscious side. In the history of symbolism, the right side generally represents the realm of consciousness, the left, the unconscious. From the left, little cars are coming down, and in each a little man is hidden. Henry is afraid that an unnoticed upward-bound car might hit him from the rear. His anxiety proves groundless, but it reveals that Henry is afraid of what, so to speak, lies behind his ego. The bloated blue-clothed men might symbolize sterile intellectual thoughts that are being brought down mechanically. Blue often denotes the function of thinking. Thus, the men might be symbols of ideas or attitudes that have died on the intellectual heights where the air is too thin. They could also represent lifeless inner parts of Henry's psyche. A comment on these men is made in the dream. It is said they are dead. But Henry is alone. Who makes this statement? It is a voice, and when a voice is heard in a dream, it is a most meaningful occurrence. Dr. Jung identified the appearance of a voice in dreams with an intervention of the self. It stands for a knowledge that has its roots in the collective fundaments of the psyche. What the voice says cannot be disputed. The insight Henry has gained about the dead formulas to which he has been too committed marks a turning point in the dream. He has at last reached the right place for taking a new direction, to the right, the conscious direction, toward the conscious and the outer world. There he finds the people he left behind waiting for him, and thus he can become conscious of previously unknown aspects of his personality. Since his ego has surmounted the dangers it confronted alone, an accomplishment that could make him more mature and stable, he can rejoin the group or collective and get shelter and food. Then comes the rain, a cloudburst that relaxes tension and makes the earth fertile. In mythology, rain was often thought to be a love union between heaven and earth. In the Eleusinian Mysteries, for instance, after everything had been purified by water, the call went up to heaven, "Let it rain," and down to earth, "Be fruitful." This was understood as a sacred marriage of the gods. In this way, rain can be said to represent a solution in the literal sense of the word. Coming down, Henry again meets the collective values symbolized by the rucksack and motorcycle. He has passed through a phase in which he has strengthened his ego consciousness by proving he can hold his own, and he has a renewed need for social contact. However, he accepts the suggestion of his friends that he should wait and fail.